From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Many authors dread having to speak with TV and newspaper reporters to promote their recently published books, but former President Jimmy Carter has said he wrote his latest book about the conflict between Israel and Palestine so that he'd be invited by the media to discuss what he believes is the most pressing human rights crisis of our time. He's given his book a provocative title, too, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings President Carter back to my show today. Hello.
Well, Leonard, it's good to be with you again.
Only once have I received more protests in advance of a guest appearance than this one. That was when Jane Fonda stopped by. I'd guess that you weren't surprised by how much controversy your book has generated, but I wonder if you had any idea how strongly critics would react to your book's title.
Well, that's been the primary reaction is to the title. Most of the people that have seemed to be critical have not read the book, or they haven't referred to anything inside Palestine. And the book is not written about Israel at all. I know Israel is a wonderful democracy with equal treatment of all citizens, whether Arab or Jew, and so I very carefully avoided talking about anything inside Israel. The book is about Palestine and what's going on inside the occupied territories, but that has aroused some criticism, which I've noticed. I don't look back too much, but I have seen some of the reviews. Most of the reviews apparently were written by people that have not yet read the book, but just have seen the title, which refers to Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
In an op-ed piece that's been published in several American newspapers over the past few days, you've written that the Palestinians may be living in conditions even more oppressive than those suffered by black South Africans.
Yes, in some ways they are. I have spent a lot of time in Palestine in recent years. We've observed all the elections, for instance, that the Palestinians have conducted with the approval, of course, of Israel before we go in. And so there's no doubt about it. The Palestinians have had their own land, first of all, occupied, then confiscated, and then colonized. They've been excluded from their own gardens and fields and pastures and churches. They have been severely restrained in their movements. They have to have different kinds of passes to go through different checkpoints inside their own land, on their own roads. The Israelis have built more than 200 settlements inside Palestine. They connect these settlements with very nice roads for the Israeli settlers and then superhighways and so forth going into Jerusalem. Quite often the Palestinians are prevented from even riding on those roads that have been built in their own territory. And so this has been in many ways worse than it was in South Africa. Of course, there were many more horrible atrocities in South Africa, but the word apartheid is quite pertinent. In fact, it has been used very clearly, even by the Attorney General who served under Prime Minister Rabin and Prime Minister Peres and also Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Would the situation have been different if an accommodation could have been reached a long time ago, if Israel's neighbors and the Palestinian leaders had been willing to recognize Israel's right to exist?
Sure, the situation could have been prevented if Israel had honored the commitments that they made with me in 1978 to withdraw from occupied territories, to withdraw all of their military and political forces from Palestine. They committed to do that, but they haven't done it. And, of course, once again, later on, in 1993, Prime Minister Rabin and Prime Minister Peres agreed again to do the same thing in the Oslo Agreement of 1993, as I said. After Prime Minister Rabin was assassinated by a fellow Israeli who didn't like the peace process, since then there hasn't been one single progress made toward peace between Israel and its neighbors. And in the last 6 years, there hasn't been one day of negotiations between Israel and its neighbors. So, yes, a lot of things could have been changed. In 2002, to answer the other part of your question, all of the Arab countries, 23 of them, debated for several days a motion made by Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who now is King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. And the proposal was that Israel be recognized to live in peace within its recognized borders by all the Arab countries, and they approved it unanimously. So the key word is within its recognized borders. That's what a minority of Israelis have not been willing to do, although a majority have always favored withdrawing from occupied territories in exchange for peace.
Although Hamas has said that it won't recognize Israel under any conditions, that it reserves the right of return and it wants the Israelis to leave. And Hamas is the government of Palestine right now.
No, that's not true in both cases, Leonard. As a matter of fact, the government of the Palestinians, the only one recognized by Israel is a Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, and the head of that government is Mahmoud Abbas. Hamas has nothing to do with the PLO. Also, the government within which Hamas does serve, the Palestine National Authority, Abbas is the head of that organization as well. And he has been eager to have peace talks with Israel ever since he was made first prime minister. And then after Arafat died, he has become president. Also, the leaders of Hamas, Haniya is the prime minister, has said that he favors direct talks between Abbas and Israel, and that if they reach an agreement that is approved by the Palestinians, that Hamas will accept it.
Well, you make it sound like they're really working well together. In today's paper, another report of killings, three sons of a Fatah official being killed in Gaza City by people who it's assumed are connected to Hamas. So there is a lot of trouble within the Palestinian community.
That's true, and I regret any sort of violence that's against innocent people, either among the Palestinians or obviously among Israelis. That's a tragedy for anybody to whom it happens. It's also, I think, a major setback for the Palestinians when they can't get a unity government inside Palestine.
In the light of the stir that your book has created, I wonder, you're 82 years old, you've been president of the United States, you've won the Nobel Peace Prize, you've created a foundation that oversees free elections around the world, you've written 21 books. Why are you causing yourself so much trouble now?
I don't feel any trouble.
Well, you have taken a controversial stand, and people are angered. In his Washington Post review yesterday, Jeffrey Goldberg suggests that this is hostility towards Israel that's faith-based on your part.
That's a ridiculous charge. I presume that Mr. Goldberg has read the book. If he does, he knows that there's nothing in that is hostile to Israel. As a matter of fact, if he would look at it objectively or anyone else, they would agree that in the last 30 years, my major goal in foreign policy, both inside the White House and since I left it, has been to bring permanent peace to Israel, along with permanent peace to their neighbors. And that's still the major goal of my life in international affairs. And I would hope that eventually that Israel would accept and their neighbors would also accept the basic premises of all the United Nations resolutions and the permanent official policy of the U.S. government and the agreements that Israeli leaders and others have signed at Camp David and later at Oslo, and also the current international quartet's so-called roadmap for peace, which President Bush has endorsed enthusiastically. All of them, every one of them, is based on the proposition that Israel must withdraw from occupied territories and negotiate the details of a settlement between Israel and its neighbors.
My guest is Jimmy Carter, whose latest book is Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Well, you've first of all, you helped to arrange the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt.
Yes.
But that also led to the assassination of Anwar Sadat. So is peace really possible when so many people in the area will not accept any kind of agreement? We saw the same thing on the other side when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by an Israeli who felt that he was getting too close to coming up with an agreement?
Well, you know, I've observed, as I said, polls for the last 30 years, and a clear, strong majority of Israelis have always favored withdrawing from occupied territories in exchange for peace. And even after the election in January in Palestine, which we, the Carter Center, monitored, 77% of the Palestinians in a poll that was done by the Harry Truman Institute within one of the universities in Israel said that they favored peace talks between Abbas and the Prime Minister of Israel, and they fully supported the proposition of having two states side by side in the Holy Land living in peace.
Well, to some degree, hasn't Israeli policy been moving in that direction? We had Ariel Sharon removing 8,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip during a pullout in July 2005. Ehud Olmert, his successor, was elected on a platform that included giving up more settlements. And didn't Israel offer the Palestinians a really attractive settlement during the 2000 Camp David summit organized by Bill Clinton? As far as I understand, PLO leader Yasser Arafat rejected it.
It was never accepted by either side. I've covered that quite thoroughly in my book. I really appreciate the great work that President Clinton did and tried to do during the last few months of his administration. That was very wonderful work. But his proposal was never accepted, as you know. And, you know, Israel did withdraw from Gaza, which is 1% of the territory between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And, of course, all that the Palestinians have left is the West Bank, which is only 22% of the total area. Israel itself comprises 77% of the land. But what Israel has wanted and demanded by a minority, as I said, is to continue the occupation of that small 22% of the land, less than a fourth, that is the West Bank. And I was very grateful and proud to see Israel withdraw from Gaza. Of course, later they went back in, and now they're out again. And I hope they will stay out. But Olmert has, although he promised ahead of time, ahead of the election, to have a substantial withdrawal from the West Bank, that commitment has been rescinded, I understand, and it no longer is extant. But even then, it's a withdrawal from just a small part of the West Bank, not leaving the Palestinians any sort of contiguous area that they could call a nation of their own.
You've identified the two biggest obstacles to peace between Israel and Palestine as, first, that some Israelis believe that they have the right to confiscate and colonize Palestinian land,
yes,
and second, some Palestinians refuse to recognize the right of Israel to exist and honor suicide bombers who kill Israelis as martyrs.
That's correct. Both of those things are terrible, and there have been horrendous casualties on both sides, even in the last 3 or 4 years. And I delineate those relative casualties in the book quite carefully, and I might say quite accurately. But the only way to ultimately have peace is what I have recommended and what you've just described.
But you said that neither side agreed to Bill Clinton's proposals. In his memoir, he placed the blame for the failure to reach an agreement on Yasser Arafat.
I realize that, and obviously President Clinton has a right to his opinion.
Well, why would he have such a different take on what happened than you do? Wasn't he there?
Yes, he was there, and I was not there. I've read I've read the documents that apply to that. I've got maps in my book that show the comparison between what the Israelis interpreted to be President Clinton's proposal and what the Palestinians interpreted. There was never a clear delineation of the map, and no Palestinian could have accepted President Clinton's proposal, as good as they were, and still survived either politically or, in my opinion, physically, because the Palestinians would have had to forego all the basic United Nations resolutions that had guaranteed their rights ever since 1967. 194 is the right to return. 242 is the demand that Israel withdraw from the occupied territories. That's all of Palestine. And also the proposal by which the argument over Jerusalem could have been resolved. And it was a wonderful effort by President Clinton in the last part of his administration, which was not accepted. As a result of that, though, although the Americans were not present, at a little coastal resort named Taba in January of 2001, after George Bush had been elected and before he was inaugurated. There were very good talks held by the same Palestinians and Israelis who had consummated the Oslo Agreement in 1993. And out of that came a wonderful proposal that would still be a foundation for peace between Israel and Egypt, and it's known as the Geneva Accords. And that spells out the solution to these three basic issues.
But the right of return is something that Israel could never accept. Just as you say, there are certain terms that no Palestinian leader could accept.
Well, the right of return is guaranteed to all Palestinians in UN Resolution 194, which was approved by the United States and still is in effect. The compromise that was reached in the Geneva Accord was that Palestinians could return to Palestine. They could only return to Israel if Israel approved each case. If they couldn't return to Israel, then they could be compensated for the land and property that they had lost. And this compromise that I described to you, the Geneva Accords, was approved publicly by the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Tony Blair, by President Clinton, by the President of France, Mr. Chirac, and by 50 other leaders around the world, including Nobel Prize winners. And it was approved also by a majority of Israelis and a majority of Palestinians in a public opinion poll that was run by the James Baker Institute. So this is a compromise, and obviously it was done unofficially. But it's a basis on which any reasonable conclusion will have to be brought after good faith talks begin again. And one of the strongest recommendations that the recent Hamilton-Baker committee made last week was that peace talks between Palestinians and Israelis commence, because they've been missing now for 6 years.
Now, you say that the poverty rate among the Palestinians living in Gaza is over 70%.
Yes.
Malnutrition has become a major problem.
Yes.
There's a high unemployment. How much of that is the responsibility of the Palestinians themselves? There was serious corruption under Arafat, and there continue to be hostile actions against Israel, including shelling and the kidnapping of soldiers, which has led to Israel closing off the borders. Couldn't the Palestinians make some moves that would make it a little easier for Israel to make some moves?
I think they could. But as a matter of fact, Israel has Gaza completely surrounded by a wall that the Israelis built. There are only two openings in that wall. And it's because of Israel's unwillingness to open Gaza to the outside world, either through airplanes or ships, or even fishermen can't go out into the ocean. They can't go into Israel to one of the openings in the wall. They can't go into Egypt and carry produce in and out, food. And obviously that creates horrendous suffering. In fact, the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations said that the plight of the Gaza Palestinians under Israel surrounding them was as poor as the poorest nations in sub-Sahara Africa, and that half of the Palestinian families inside Gaza were living on one meal per day. And as you say, there have been provocations by the Palestinians. A number of months ago, some Palestinians, we don't know which ones, dug underneath the wall and captured an Israeli soldier, which precipitated a crisis, as I admit. And then the Palestinians offered to swap that one soldier for some of the 9,200 prisoners that Israel is holding who are Palestinians. And they were willing to confine the swap just to women and children. The Israelis are holding about 300 children who are Palestinians, some of them 12 years old. They're holding 94 women as of the 1st of October. And the Palestinians said, okay, we'll swap this soldier to you if you'll just release some of our women and children. And the Israelis refused to swap.
You've described the U.S. media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian struggle as abominable. Do you think that we get different news than people in other parts of the world get?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. When I go to Israel, in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or wherever, there are intense debates in Israel about what Israel should do in Palestine, to withdraw or not to withdraw, to punish the Palestinians or to refrain from punishing the Palestinians, and so forth. And it's the same, obviously, in Arab countries and also in Europe. But in this country, that sort of debate is almost completely non-existent. I might say that, I'm not bragging about it, but since my book came out, I've had pretty good access to the public media, including your very fine radio station. And I've been on a lot of talk shows. But as far as op-ed pieces, editorials, and the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and so forth, they're almost totally absent. And there's only one side of those intense debates in the Holy Land that is ever described in any sort of consistent way within the American news media, and that's Israel's side, to the exclusion of any balance between them and the Palestinian side.
So your op-ed piece, which I mentioned earlier, was printed in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the San Jose Mercury News, the St. Paul Pioneer Press, which is solid mid-sized newspapers, but by no means national papers. Did you submit it to the Times, the L.A. Times or the Washington Post?
Yes, the L.A. Times published the same op-ed piece. And as I say, since my book came out, there has been some coverage, which is one of the main reasons I wrote the book, is just to have a debate or discussion based on what I present is the facts from the Palestinian point of view, hoping that this might bring about some resolution of differences and eventually lead, possibly, to peace talks that could give Israel what I pray to see someday, and that is peace, permanent peace, acceptance by all their neighbors, and also peace for their neighbors.
Jimmy Carter's latest book is Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. It is published by Simon & Schuster. I want to thank you so much for being on our show again.
I've enjoyed it, Leonard, very much. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.